Donald in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we are here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. And I've got a little message for you here. Matter of fact, I've got a secret for you. KHOI is Central Iowa's best-kept secret, and we'd like to change that. We are encouraging you to tell a friend, tell a neighbor, colleague, classmate about KHOI. There's a great station here in Central Iowa that plays great music and deals with important issues like our show. So you can find out more about this radio station at www.khoifm.org. And welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. So, friends, tell a friend about this radio station, and it really does come all the way down to getting along. Joining us today is author Michael Perry. He knows about community and friends. I've enjoyed reading Michael Perry's books for a long time. Michael Perry is an accidental New York Times best-selling author, according to his biography. A corporate speaker, humorist, singer, songwriter, amateur snowplow driver, and playwright from New Auburn, Wisconsin. He has written many great books, Population 45, Truck, A Love Story, Visiting Tom, Coop, and those are memoirs about his life. And he's written a novel called The Jesus Cow, Peaceful Persistence, Hunker, and 40 Acres Deep. Good stuff all. Welcome, Michael Perry.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Good. So, you come from, I would like to refer to as my neck of the woods, kind of north of Iowa, and I've always enjoyed your work because there is a, I recognize Wisconsin right away and small town Wisconsin. So, tell us about living in where you do in Wisconsin, and tell us about the small towns. You wrote a book called Population 485 about a small town, and it sort of struck a real chord with me. So tell us about it, Michael.
Yeah, I was a farm kid. I was raised on a tiny little dairy farm in northern Wisconsin, just north of that little village of New Auburn, Wisconsin. And grew up milking cows, baling hay. In the winter, we logged. So I grew up skidding logs and slinging slabs on the sawmill. And then at the age of 16, I started working summers on a ranch in Wyoming, a regular working beef and hay ranch. So that is definitely my background, just working, logging, rounding up cows, making hay, that sort of thing. Went K through 12 to the same little school in New Auburn, Wisconsin. It was horseshoe shaped. You went in one end for kindergarten, and 13 years later, if everything stayed on schedule, you came out the other end. And I went off to college. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I got a nursing degree and I started working as a nurse. And then I accidentally started writing. It's a little more complicated story than that, but it was never my intent to become a writer. And frankly, I was a kid who grew up reading books all the time on the farm. I was raised in an obscure fundamentalist Christian sect, and I like to say that because it makes people uncomfortable. But if you read the book Coop, go into that pretty deeply. And I was actually in this very gentle, loving family. And I'm no longer part of that particular group, but I'm grateful every day for the parents I had and the family I had and being raised a farm kid. And so that all gave me, I was very fortunate. We were below the poverty line by definition, but I always say, you know, every night when I went to bed, I was never hungry and I always knew I was loved. So I had the two greatest privileges that you can possibly have. And so it was that background, just growing up simply. And oh, and the reason I brought up the church was that we weren't allowed to have television or go to movies or dances. Or
sounds like
that.
A good idea these days.
Well, it worked out because my mom filled the house with books, and we would go to the little local library in our tiny little hometown there, or the town up the road. My town was so small we didn't have a library. But we'd go 9 miles up the road to the public library and come home with all kinds of books. So I read voraciously as a kid. But the thing is, when you're doing chores, cleaning calf pens in rural Wisconsin, and even if you're a reader, authors are these distant, mysterious people. I always say they have a capital A author designation. So as much as I loved books and even enjoyed writing assignments, it just never occurred to me that I could possibly do that for a living. So I also knew pretty early on I loved hard work and I loved being on the farm. I loved working on the ranch, but I don't have mechanical aptitude. I'm not good at fixing things. I don't understand electricity. And no matter how many times my parents or my brothers tried to explain it to me, it just never stuck. So that's why I realized early that, you know, probably I'm not going to be a farmer or a logger or a mechanic. And I wound up in nursing school and then just started writing. But 12 years after I moved away, I graduated from high school and I went to college. 12 years later, I came back and I bought a house on Main Street. And I lived there for 12 years in my hometown. And so the book Population 485 is about coming back to that hometown. And the thing I joke about is that when I came back, I'd been gone for 12 years, and I wasn't the same guy when I came back as when I left. So I'm always just trying to decide, is this the right decision? And I'm quite a loner. I always have been. And so I'm not a good joiner. I didn't belong to any of the local churches. I didn't belong. I don't drink, so I didn't go to any of the taverns in town. And it being Wisconsin, I don't bowl, I don't play softball, and I can't polka. And so there really wasn't much left to do. So what I did is I joined the volunteer fire department. I was already an EMT at that point, working on the ambulance. So I took the firefighter training. I work with a lot of folks on the coast in L.A. and New York. And they're often surprised to find out that I'm a volunteer firefighter / first responder. Because they just don't come from an area of where that's common. And so they'll say things to me like, oh, you must be very brave and noble. And I always go, yeah, not especially. And then I explain to them that when I moved back to my hometown, my two brothers and my mom were already on the fire department.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't about being brave or noble. It was about not wanting to be the only one at Sunday supper with no stories to tell. So that's just really kind of my background. And so even though I wound up writing and I'm writing music and performing, I do a lot of one-man shows. I do a lot of speaking for corporate organizations, but I also take I have a 2002 Toyota van with all the seats ripped out, and I throw my boxes of books and my T-shirts and my music in there. And I was just down in southern Wisconsin this week speaking to a group of about 200 people who are supporting the local fire department and the local library, my favorite combination. I do a lot of that. I'm on the road probably 80 to 100 days a year doing these little shows or talks. And but I just approach it from how I was raised, which was my dad got up every day and he milked the cows twice a day and he did all the chores and he did all the things you had to and no one was applauding. He just kept at it. And he had my mom at his side who was taking care of this huge, unusual family, which I describe in the book Coop. They adopted. I have three adopted siblings and countless foster siblings, some of whom were with us for their whole lives because they had terminal conditions. So when it came to writing, I'm a knucklehead, man. I love old pickup trucks and playing football and deer hunting. And you can see behind me, I like deer hunting. But I also entered this world where I learned to love poetry and art and beauty and people who are sensitive and dancers. And so I kind of live in these two different worlds where I'm very comfortable down to the fire hall, as I would say, or at the dirt track stock car races. But I also love going to see a Shakespeare play. I have a daughter who wound up singing opera. And, you know, for me, I grew up on Waylon Jennings. So from Waylon Jennings to opera is that's a journey. But ultimately, I need to let you ask some questions, so I'll try to stop rambling. Bottom line is, I love what I do. I love beauty, art, sensitivity. I try for all those things, but it always comes through this frame of the blue-collar kid who just grew up stacking firewood and milking cows. I one of my earliest memories is falling backwards into a gutter full of soupy manure. And I've always said I love that memory because it's the perfect bar to set for the rest of your life. It's like whatever has happened, you can go, well, I'm not laying in a gutter full of soupy manure. So things are going great.
Oh, you're a positivist. I love this. Optimist. Very good. Very good. You, in this, I hate to bring up the upcoming election, but it seems every 4 years people get all sort of interested in, oh, what do people in rural America think? What are small towns thinking? People go to these cafes and put microphones in people's faces. And you mentioned that New Auburn isn't like it was when you wrote the book, but have the people changed? Or are people pretty much as you found them when you came back and started working on the fire department?
I think it's a split answer. What I feel when I'm on the fire department is the same, and that's why I love the fire department. Now, I want to be clear. I live in a different fire district now. I am a member of the local department, but because of my schedule and what I do, I make a handful of calls a year. So what I don't want to do is project myself as some sort of a leading rescue hero. I'm just literally, if I'm around and it works and I can make it to the call, I go. But that could be as few as five calls a year at this point, whereas mm-hmm. I used to make over 100 a year. Having said that, one of the reasons that I still do it is I just love going to the fire department meetings or going to the scene of whatever we've been called to. And I know for a fact that some of the people that I'm sharing space with, some of the people that I'm working beside, I know that we don't see the world the same way, which is a polite way of saying we're not going to pull the same lever. And that troubles me on some point. But in that moment, we literally speak the same language. We speak the language of rescue or fire suppression. We have a shared goal. We are just humans trying to help humans. And that's what I cling to. That's what I see as the same. I don't think there's any question that the way media is distributed has changed the feel of things. I remember, I think in my book, 40 Acres Deep, which is fiction, but I write about him watching the old men, the old farmers down at the implement store around the the coffee maker. And that's drawn from my own life. I remember those old farmers, and they were teasing each other about their politics. And today it seems like it's a little harder to tease them about their politics. It immediately turns bitter. But having said that, I totally get what you're saying about, yeah, every 4 years they drop someone in the cafe to just get the pulse of the people. And it's so much more complicated than that. I tend to operate in a world when I'm functioning as an artist or speaking at universities or certain settings where it's assumed that I think a certain way. And I will hear, you know, really dark things. They're like, how can you live where you live? And I go, well, because these are my neighbors. And things are complicated and it's not so simple. And when you live where I do, if you don't agree with everybody, you don't have the luxury of dismissing them. And so you have
exactly.
to. And on the flip side, I'm always sticking up. You know, I mentioned earlier, I work with people in L.A. and New York. And these days, when I mention that, I have a whole humorous bit I do about that in my live performances. And it used to be kind of the chuckle of, oh, those folks. And now you'll hear kind of this derisive laughter. And I right away jump in and go, no. I love going to New York City. It's filled with energy. It's filled with fascinating people. I love going to art museums. And guess what? I can still come home and go deer hunting and go to the dirt track stock car races. And those people in New York City that I will tease a little bit about, they have no idea the difference between Iowa and Wisconsin. But they've also got tremendous skills and talents, and they've changed my life. And they work really hard at their job. And so I'm constantly, and I'm not famous enough to make a difference, but I am constantly searching for those connections that aren't broken, and it's not always easy, but they're there, and I think they're as important as ever. And then as far as to go all the way back to your original question, have things changed? Yes, they have changed, but I also love to read history and biographies of French philosophers who lived in the 1700s, and you know what? Ain't none of this new.
Well, I like to think about the rural-urban divide, as people say, because although I am a small-town Midwestern girl, for 40 years I lived in both New York and L.A. and then finally got to come back to the Midwest. And I tell people, you know the old story about the country mouse and the city mouse? That's so illustrative for me of the two different values, you know, and the flash of the city, and the country mouse goes and he loves it, and then he sees the cat, right? And then he's happy to go back to the country. It's an old story. I like being a country girl.
Yeah, that's my happiest. I'm sitting right now on what is still our back 40. Like I said, the city keeps getting closer to us, and it's a coming. But I'm sitting here by choice in rural Wisconsin, and I get to work with people in LA. I get to work with people in New York City. I'm on the road a lot, and I just spent a bunch of time in Minneapolis recently, and I'll have some of my country friends. They'll be like, "Oh, be careful, be careful." I'm like, "Dude, I'm careful everywhere, including here." So, I think it's. I guess what I'm looking. It just comes down to rural folks and city folks have both enriched my life in ways I never anticipated or expected. And to me, I want to acknowledge that with gratitude rather than, I can joke about, and believe me, I've got a whole like 20 minute humor bit that I do about trying to explain to New York people why they should fly me out of the Minneapolis airport instead of the Milwaukee airport, even though I live in Wisconsin. And they're like, "But you live in Wisconsin." And I said, "Yes, but I'm an hour and a half from Minneapolis." And they said, "But that's in Minnesota." And I said, "Well, we have an open border agreement."
Well, I that's what I love about your work. It really is. First of all, I want to let everybody know that I think you are a very fine writer, in addition to being a very good storyteller, and you can turn a fine phrase, as a cliche would say. I really enjoyed your work, and it's wonderful. It's sort of like my mom and I used to both, one of the few things we could agree on in her old age was she loved to read Wendell Berry's fiction. And I think she would also appreciate your work because, of course, you're younger than Wendell, but that same voice of rural values. And you know what? You are a really fine writer, which is always a pleasure to read. So
tis good. I want to you mentioned a little bit before. I'd like to kind of turn the discussion to food and feeding your family. And you talk a little bit about gardens and growing pigs and growing chickens and. One thing about, and you mentioned it already, deer hunting, the concept of harvesting deer, that's not something that has been lost, especially in Wisconsin. And actually, yes.
Around here, too.
Deer hunting is opening up here, too.
We have corn-fed deer.
Very much, very much. So, I assume that you still hunt and enjoy it and share things and put things in the freezer?
Yeah, I already made fun of myself for not being a good mechanic. And it's so funny whenever, especially New York Publishing, they promote me as this roughneck rural Wisconsin writer. And, I do have a snowplow on my pickup truck and I do go deer hunting. But whenever my brothers who are loggers and heavy equipment operators hear that I'm a roughneck, they're like, "Show us your hands." The hands of a typist. Yeah. And so I've made fun of myself for not being the roughest of roughnecks. But deer hunting to me is just utterly natural. We eat venison almost year round here in our little family. And at this point, I go out back hunting. if I'm fortunate enough to get a deer, I register it online. I used to have to take it into town. I register it online. I take it into the pole barn. I skin it. I quarter it. We process it ourselves. It never leaves the farm. And so I'm now, again, what you find when you talk to me and if you read my books is that I call myself a witty generalist. So like when I wrote the book Coop about raising pigs, I'd get all these and chickens too, I'd get these emails from people saying, what do you advise we do? You know, what breed is this? What feed? And I'd always go, did you read the book? The whole point of that book is you shouldn't be asking me for advice on how to farm. You should be talking to a real farmer. But in the case of the venison, yeah, that is one thing that, you know, we just, it's literally farm to table. And I did chuckle at your cornfed remark. You still, I'll run into people, they go, well, I don't know, venison, it tastes so gamey. And I say, well, there's two things, you know. I said, first of all, if you've had gamey venison, it was 40 years ago and somebody left it hanging in a tree for 3 weeks. And then secondly, it doesn't taste gamey around here because they are dining on the finest corn and the finest soybeans. And yet here, okay, so this is an aside, but we live, if you could see out the window right now, if you don't see trees, you see cornfields or soybean fields. And so, and then if you don't see that, you just see endless forest. And yet, if you go into my yard, 40 yards from here, by our deck, you will see that the deer have completely decimated the hostas. I'll go, what is it you're missing in your diet that you have to eat our hostas? Would you look around?
Well, so, deer are apparently quite discriminating. A local farmer friend of mine who's an organic farmer, he says that deer in his neighborhood will walk an extra mile to get the organic corn.
I'm going to take his word for it.
Well, I believe it. Well, I come from a deer hunting tradition too, and putting up our own is a good thing. And you just seem to have a better appreciation for such. I also like to garden a lot too, and so the stuff that is closest to the back door generally gets us through the winter, and it's a good thing. It's a good thing. Also, that is a gun thing. But yes, I own a gun. Well, yes, I do. And unfortunately, it's turned up because it gets used for other things, not a very good thing. But I can see hunting as being, well, it's part of our heritage and it's part of how we feed ourselves. So there you go. There you go.
Well, and Lana has a friend who hunts on her land with a bow. What kind of bow? Bow and arrow or something.
Probably. Oh, yeah, probably a compound bow.
Yeah, compound bow.
If I could, I would, but I can't use a compound
bow. Can't pull it back.
What the heck with that? Okay. Besides, it's so nice to have somebody else do the hunting for me now. It's very good. Very good. So you have wonderful, funny stories about making your chicken coop, or actually, you got a lot of help with your chicken coop, because like you said, not everybody is handy with tools, but you got a chicken coop made anyway.
I always say I've built an entire career based on my own incompetence.
Your Midwestern modesty right there, right?
You've made an observation, because there's a recurring theme in my work, which is I write about other people helping me do things. My favorite is the one I don't feel guilty about at all. So I wrote a book called Truck, A Love Story. And in that book, I tear down a 1951 L120 three-quarter ton International Harvester long bed pickup truck and put it back together. And of course I don't. I do it with the help of my brother-in-law, who's a very talented machinist and mechanic. But I'm very open about it. I mean, again, that is part of the humor. I just go, look, folks, I'm going to need some help. And so I get my brother-in-law. But my favorite, this is such a great Midwestern blue-collar story, where art and, you know, high art literature meets the local shop. So I approach my brother-in-law. I said, hey, man, I'm writing this book, and in order to write it, I have to tear this truck apart and put it back together, and I'm going to need help. And I said, I'd like to ask you to help me, but I can't ask you to do it for free. And he said, well, is it really rusty? And I said, yeah, it's really rusty. He goes, well, we're probably going to need a plasma cutter to cut the rust out. And the plasma cutters were a pretty new, exciting thing at that time. And so I said, well, here's the deal. I'll buy the plasma cutter And we'll use it to tear the truck down and fix the truck. And when we're done, as pay, you can keep the plasma cutter. And he was very happy about that and thought it was a fair deal. And so when we finished, I gave him the plasma cutter. But what I didn't tell him until later, and by the way, I did check this with my accountant, is that plasma cutter was tax deductible because I used it.
That's very good. Very good. I want to take it.
It's not always about coming up with the perfect metaphor or simile. Sometimes it's about the perfect tax deduction.
Very good.
It's a business.
I want to take the opportunity here to say that this is KHOI. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That's a bit of banjo music by Merle Hall from Granger, Iowa. It's called In the Rain. We could use some. Yes, we could. We're talking to Michael Perry about his wonderful way of making a living. He has a lot of hats in the ring. Mainly he's an author, but he does a lot of other things too. It's such a joy to talk to you. I want to talk specifically, Micah, about humor. Humor. You've always made me laugh, but I received from you in the mail this T-shirt, and I've been wearing it around. And on the front of this T-shirt, there's a picture of a traffic sign, square traffic sign with a cow on it. And on the back, it says, "Never stand behind a sneezing cow." Now, Sneezing Cow is the name of your, what's your website and your company and everything. And believe it or not, Michael, I've had to explain that T-shirt to a lot of people. I saw it, of course, that's how it works. I was funny. Is there such thing as Wisconsin humor?
Yeah, so I love that question because years ago, I did a live humor recording called Never Stand Behind a Sneezing Cow and produced it myself, recorded it myself. I rented a church and hired someone to record it. And then at that time, put it out on cassettes. And I took it to every Quick Trip within 80 miles of my house and set up a little display. And that's kind of one of the ways I got started, was making $12 a pop off my cassettes.
Ooh.
But that thing got pretty popular, and popular enough that a record company that specialized in humor out of Nashville asked me to come down and meet with them to see. They were going to maybe put that Never Stand Behind a Sneezing Cow album out as an album by a bona fide big, you know, they produced people like Louis Grizzard and some pretty well-known humorists at the time. And I made it all the way to the final meeting with the president of the record label in Nashville. I still remember sitting at the table down there. And they said, you know, we love this stuff, but we just, you know, Midwestern humor just doesn't translate. And I remember sitting there going, wait a minute, you guys have us laughing at your Southern humor all day long. And you're telling me that I don't think it's that it doesn't translate. I think it's that you have already cornered the market. But rather than being upset, I was just like, okay, well, you know, at least now I know. So in some sense, I do agree that regional humor doesn't always translate. I think regional humor is getting more and more dilute as we mix and move around the country. But even more than that, I've noticed with things that I thought I came up with that were pretty witty 20 years ago, I see people tweeting them all the time, and they'll say, oh, I was just thinking about this. And one of the things about social media, and there's a ton, and we're not here to talk about that today, Well, one of the things is you find out you're not as smart or as funny as you thought you were. Like, I'll see something and I'll think, oh, I have a funny idea about that. And I'll go to put it on a Twitter or something. And you realize, oh, I'm the 15th person to come up with that. And, you know, it turns out you're not as genius as you thought you were. But to answer your question, yeah, so there do seem to be some limitations. On the other hand, what really encourages me is that I have done that sneezing cow joke in San Francisco, L.A., New York. I've done it in Manhattan at a reading. What I tell people is it's not that people still laugh. It's just that around here, when I'm doing it at the local in Lancaster, Wisconsin, and there's a bunch of farmers in the audience, I get what I call the laugh of recognition. Whereas in L.A., I get the laugh of horror. When you explain it to them, they just can't believe what they've heard. Now, here's a fine point about humor. I did that joke for years, never stand behind a sneezing cow. And by the way, if you're listening and you don't know, it basically, when a cow sneezes, products shoot out the back and not milk. That's all we need to say. And if you've ever grown up on a farm like I have, it has happened to me. And it is what I say, it is a jaw-dropping experience, although that would not be your best move. But anyway, what I love about the distinctions of humor, I did this at some small library in rural Wisconsin, and afterwards I'm signing books, there's a line of people, and this very elderly farmer comes up, and he says, young man, I have a bone to pick with you. And I said, well, get in line. And he said, you said never stand behind a sneezing cow, but cows don't sneeze, they cough. And he's absolutely right. That when that happens, the cow is actually coughing. And I said, sir, as a former farm boy, I want to tell you that you are absolutely correct. A cow doesn't sneeze, it coughs. But as a humorist, a sneezing cow is way funnier than a coughing cow.
Oh, bless you. Bless you. Yes.
He agreed with me.
Well, I want to thank you for your Wisconsin humor, because there are things in Wisconsin that I just think are, I'm from Wisconsin, and I spent time at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, which is up in your neck of the woods, and I lived up there for a while. There are things in Wisconsin I think are just funny, and not funny, they're funny, they bring a smile to me, and I'm sure regionally there are other places, but Wisconsin is funny, well, cows are funny, but just the concept of cheese curds to me are funny. And smelt is funny. That's a fish. Ice fishing is funny. And I think blaze orange hunting vests are funny. Nobody looks good in a blaze orange hunting vest, you know? And there's just things that bring a smile. And I thank you for bringing these things out. These things are important to share with the rest of the world.
So have you heard about my story about my Montaigne book?
No.
Go ahead.
So I mentioned earlier, you know, there's enough tribalism and nastiness in the world. So when I poke fun at my friends in New York, it is poking fun. It is not denigrating them. And what I say is that I owe them so much. But there is no getting around the fact that the folks out on the East Coast occasionally are very concerned about us narrow-minded provincials. And I say occasionally I do take some pleasure in reminding them that sometimes out here in the Midwest, we think things up all by ourselves. And so I don't mind occasionally bringing our culture to them. So when I wrote a book called Montaigne and Barn Boots, and it's about a French philosopher and essayist, and, you know, academics have made entire careers out of parsing just one of his essays. And here I am, some knucklehead. Literally, this is how the book began. Yeah. I was sitting on my deer stand reading Montaigne's essays from the 1500s on my iPhone. And I thought, you know, I should write about Montaigne because the world needs to hear from me. But it really was about, you know, I heard a gentleman say the other day, someone had said the world needs fewer philosophers and more welders. And I expected this gentleman to say, yeah. And instead, he said what I feel, which is, no, I think the world needs more philosophers who know how to weld and more welders who read philosophy. And, you know, I hear that thing about, you know, the our forefathers, the people who founded this country, well, a lot of those fellows were farmers who read French and philosophy. And so it doesn't need to be a split. It's like you can do both things. So that's a recurring theme. So anyway, I'm deciding, well, I'm going to write this book called Montaigne in Barn Boots, where a knucklehead like me reads this philosopher and just goes, well, here's what it means to me. I could be wrong. And so when it came time to do the cover for the book, they asked me what I wanted on the cover, and it was this award-winning book jacket designer working on it. He's really good. And I said, well, you're the guy. I mean, I'm not going to tell you what to do. This is your art form. But I said, but if you do use an image of Montaigne, based on the times he lived, you're going to use one of three images, because there's only three that exist. They're engravings or paintings. So I said, whatever image you use for this book, we need to convey that this is, yes, it's about philosophy and about French philosophy, but it really is just a common dude trying to figure this stuff out. So I said, to convey that visually, I want Montaigne to be wearing a blaze orange ear flapper cap. Well, I'm sitting on the phone here in rural Wisconsin. They're all in a conference room around a big table in a room on the 17th floor of a glass building in Manhattan. And when I said blaze orange ear flapper cap, there was just silence. And then the award-winning book jacket designer said, well, what's a blaze orange cap? And I said, well, you're in luck, because mine is right beside my writing desk. So I took my phone, snapped a picture of it, sent it to him. Now, to be fair to them, he then freehand drew a very good-looking cap on Montaigne. And then the one where I'm building to about the cultural part of this is, I then called a buddy of mine who's a graphic designer but grew up in northern Wisconsin like me, and I said, can you get me the Pantone number for DNR-approved street-legal blaze orange? And he got it for me, and I sent it to the designer in New York, and I said, whatever you do, you have to use this color orange. A couple months passed. They send me back the mock-up of the cover. It looks fine. It looks great. He's drawn this really cool cap, but the orange is all washed out and pale. Doesn't look anything like blaze orange. And so they said, well, what do you think? And I said, the cover looks great. But I said, but I asked you to use that one very specific color, and it's clear you didn't. And this award-winning New York City book jacket designer said, yeah, we talked about that, and we just decided folks aren't going to notice the difference. And at that point, I did say, you know, this may be why the country's in the state it's in. And so I said, no, I must insist. And if you, to be fair to them, it's very difficult to replicate blaze orange on paper stock. And so on the dust jacket and the paperback cover, it's pretty close. But if you happen to get a copy of the hardcover and you look at the spine, the cloth spine, it glows, man. It is. It is legal in the state of Wisconsin in the last week of November. So that's my little part in just trying to export our culture to the reverse hinterlands.
That is a brave, brave effort and a brave success. Oh, I love it. I love it.
Well, you're staying genuine, you know. That's important.
I hope so. I try. Yeah. And you know what? Here's another thing that's cool about, I live in rural Wisconsin still. I'm going to do a concert in my hometown in November with my band and tell some stories. And I told someone who was like, oh, we should charge this or that. I said, listen, you're going to have a hard time getting anybody to show up, because I can go down to Madison, Wisconsin to a nice little 400-seat jewel box theater with my band, and we can sell out 400 seats. If I go to my hometown, we better make it free. And we better hope they're not a football game.
Isn't it
and
true?
Why should they be?
Yes, it's
and
you
so
cannot
I
be.
I love the fact. The fact that my brothers log and run heavy equipment, and they're all the time someone will go, oh, is your brother the author? And they're like, well, yeah, because he couldn't fix tractors. So they had to find them.
Well, but you know, you cannot be a prophet in your hometown, right?
No.
It's
no.
Healthy though. I mean, it's healthy because I have had some wonderful experiences where I've been allowed to go hang out in what I call the cool kids club. You know, at literary festivals and conferences and things. And there, I love that. It's so uplifting and energizing for me. But I always come back here thinking, you know, too much of that and you lose touch. Mm-hmm. Not everybody does. Some people are really good at it. But it's just a little too easy to start believing your own press. And so I don't mind being back here where my hometown, man, like Population 45 has been out for 22 years. So if you went back there now, people say, oh, yeah, we stopped at the gas station and the person behind the counter didn't know who you were. I'm like, it doesn't surprise me, nor should they worry themselves about it.
That is life. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. I want to remind you that you can tell a friend about KHOI Radio and get some good programming into your ears. Welcome back. We're talking to Michael Perry. Michael, I really appreciate the honesty in your writing. And not just honesty about the world around you, but about yourself. In my stack of Michael Perry books, I seem to recall a book of short essays that you wrote for other things, something about danger men working or something, and it was about all of the joys of being a man, and I was impressed with how well you talk about being a man in this culture and trying things that men don't normally do.
So that's fascinating, because I've written millions of words at this point, and I know the book you're talking about, but I'm not sure which essay that was.
Okay. It was a compilation of something. It talked about, you going to getting your eyebrows waxed and that kind of stuff.
Oh, no. It all came roaring back now. Yes. So I used to write for Men's Health Magazine.
That's it.
And I always got such a kick out of that, because if you're familiar with Men's Health Magazine, what I said is that I was not the guy they put on the cover. I would always say, I haven't had an ab in my life. And if I did have one, I'm not sure I would wax it. But what happened is, I do absolutely remember what you're asking about now. So I had a great editor there. There's another example. Like, I love to make, poke fun at Men's Health and cologne and bare midriffs and all that. But I had a fantastic editor there. He sent me on some of the most interesting stories, and he let me write. You mentioned guns earlier. I wrote about what it was like growing up, where that was just a tool that we had around the house. And he just let me really delve. He let me write essays about how important my mom was to me. And so it really did go beyond the whole bro culture thing with him. Mm-hmm. This particular instance, it was back at the height of, I don't know if the term is even still in use anymore, but metrosexuals, which was guys caring about how their nails looked and how they dressed and that sort of thing. And so that whole piece was, and there's a big punchline at the end of this, I went deer hunting for 9 days straight. And then the day after deer hunting, without having shaved or anything, I did shower, but as I mentioned in the piece, when I got to my hotel room in New York, I could see I still had some deer blood in my cuticles. They put me in this very swanky hotel in New York City. They had a limo pick me up every morning for 3 days in a row, and they took me to get basically a man makeover. I got fitted for nice clothes. I got the first thing I did, which was actually wonderful, was I got a hot straight razor shave from this old barber, and the towels and all that. That was great. But I got massages. I got skin treatments. I got a mani-pedi. I think it was a $90 haircut from a French hairstylist. And I don't know how many people, I don't know that anyone can actually see, but if you could, when they were done, it looked a lot like the haircut I have today, which I did with a Walmart clippers, because I ain't got much hair, frankly. And then they sent me, oh, and I got my eyebrows. They were going to wax them, but then they plucked them. It was horrifyingly painful. I don't drink. They said, well, most people have a highball before we do this. And I understood why when it was over, as the tears were streaming into my ears because I was laying on my back. But the kicker, the topper of the whole thing is at the very end of all this plucking and tweezing and shaping and everything, they sent me for a full body spray tan.
Oh!
I'll spare you the details. It's in the book. Let's just say it was very thorough. But the kicker of this whole thing is I took the assignment seriously. I was like, I'm going to learn what I can. I'm going to write. And, it'll be funny, but I'll also be respectful. And the piece got killed. My editor thought it was great, but the fashion editor got upset because he said I didn't take the assignment seriously enough. Good news is just that. So they killed the piece. It never showed up in the magazine. But the good news about that is the way my contract is structured, they had to pay me to kill it, and then the rights became mine. So I was able to put it in that book. And you didn't ask me this, but I'm going to ramble right into it anyway. One of the you talked about how I tell stories or whatever, but honestly, the greatest privilege I can be given is to be trusted to tell the story of another. And even when I'm writing memoirs, I'm really, I wrote a memoir called Visiting Tom, and it's about me and our farm and what we're doing. But the main character is not me. The main character is my fascinating neighbor, Tom, who's in his 80s, a jack of all trade, builds his own cannons, can make anything under the sun and has. But in that book, Danger Man Working, there's a goofy, silly piece about me going to New York City for a makeover. But that book opens with one of the most meaningful stories I've ever been allowed to write, which is I climbed Mount Rainier with two soldiers who'd been horribly injured in the war. And to be trusted to climb beside those two men and listen to their story, not dig it out of them, let it emerge on their own terms, and then write about what they'd been through and how they feel now.
Wait, Michael, which war?
Would have been Iraq.
Iraq, oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And to be clear, it's been a long time, so I don't want to misspeak. I'm not sure if it was Afghanistan or Iraq, but it was that era. And so just, there's a case where, I write a lot of memoir, which is by definition about me, because that's what the publishers asked me to do. But a long, long time ago, I heard a writer I respect say, anytime you type the term capital I, it should be transparent. If you're asking people to look at you, you should be functioning as a lens for them to be seeing others or other things. And so even though a lot of my writing is, and no one's more baffled by this than me, but about me, I'm always hoping that it's a way for us to be looking into other lives and other people.
And a good job of it too. Yes. Before we go, I want to ask you about your music. Tell us a little about the music, and you have a band. Go ahead.
Yeah, that all started as an accident. Back before I was had kids, I was a bachelor until I was 39, and a lot of reasons for that, but we don't have enough time to cover it today. But I would tend to start writing at about 6 o'clock at night and go till 3, 4 in the morning. And when there were a couple of things happening there. Number one, I was young. And number two, I didn't have family responsibilities, so I could just catch up the next day. And so I tend to be a binge writer. Once I get going, I'll go for hours and hours, especially, as I said, back before I had kids. And I would want to take a break, but I didn't want to turn off whatever part of that your brain it is that it's taken you so long to get rolling. It's a flywheel effect. And so the way I would take breaks is I learned 3 chords on the guitar, just enough to be dangerous. And I just started writing songs, and it was a way for me to stop typing but not turn off my brain, and then I'd go back to writing. And I did this for many years, and I had about 25 or 30 songs, and then a buddy of mine who's an actual performing musician found out, and he said, oh, we got to play those. You need to play those for people. And I said, oh, no, that terrifies me. I get sweaty just thinking about it. But he just went ahead and booked us into a coffee shop without telling me. And then he said, we got a gig. So the joke that I make that's not too far from the fact is that the very first show I ever did where I was playing and singing in front of people, I ain't saying I was nervous, but I cranked out a 60-minute set in 32 minutes flat. But the deal was, People, they seemed to like it, and they asked us back. And the second time, there were more people than the first time. And then what happened is I had gotten married around that time, and my wife had already seen how much time I spent on the road, even when I didn't have a band. And then I came home, I said, well, it looks like I have a band. And she said, in her very pragmatic Midwestern way, she said, well, that sounds great. That's fine, as long as within a year, it's operating in the black. And so... I said, that's fair enough. And so I've been very businesslike about it. We have a wonderful time. We're pretty selective about what we do. We do all original music, occasionally one Waylon Jennings cover. And so I'm very, like, I get called a lot by fire departments. They say, we're having a firefighter's dance. You'd be perfect. You're a firefighter. You got a band. You're kind of a roughneck country guy. And they go, you probably better not hire us because I do all original music. Nobody's going to know that. And it's, we're not really like whoop it up and drink and dance band. So I actually talk myself out of a lot of gigs.
Yeah.
We do a lot of shows just in little theaters and little spaces where people can sit and listen. And it's been a blast. And yeah, it's actually helped pay for the kids' college. So.
Oh, wonderful. Your band is called the Long Beds, which is a wonderful name for a band. And we've got a tune... called Alice Mayhew, kind of queued up and ready to go. Do you want to say a few words about this tune before we play a bit of it?
Yeah, a lot of people ask me, when you write these songs, so much of my writing is nonfiction, and they say, are these real people? And I say, no, my songs, by and large, unless they're about me and my wife or something, they're not about real people, but they're absolutely drawn on the people I live with, grew up with. And so Alice Mayhew Jackson, she doesn't exist, but she's a woman breaking free of a very difficult, that's too polite, an abusive relationship. And of course, she's not a real person, but I have, of course, also met her many, many times on the ambulance. So that's the story of Alice.
Let's listen to a little bit, then we'll, let's do that.
Alice Mayhew Jackson picked herself right up off the floor. One eye was swelling shut, she had a pain in her gut. There was a drunk man weeping by the door. Alice, she went maybe 97 pounds soaking wet, but she pushed right by that man with the bottle in his hand. She said, if you got any sense at all, you'll get. If I have been a good wife, and I have lived a good life, and I am through entertaining you.
We'll hear a little bit more of that music later. Michael, thank you for being with us today. And can you give us some information on how to contact you?
Yeah, the very best thing you can do is just go to sneezingcow.com. Spelled just the way you'd expect. No space between sneezing and cow. Sneezingcow.com. If you scroll down just a little bit, there's a post that's pinned to the top that will just pretty much tell you. I have a Substack, a weekly podcast. It will tell you where the music is, tells you where to find all the books. And and also, here's the biggest thing. I'm coming through Iowa here in a bit for some events. And if you sign up for our mailing list, and if all we have is just your email and your zip code, we can let you know when I'm getting close. And we keep that mailing list to ourselves. We don't sell it or share it with anybody. But yeah, sneezingcow.com. And thank you so much for having me.
Well, we hope to see you around here in Ames.
Thank you very much, Michael Perry. Michael Perry, a really good guy to get to talk to. Yes, it is. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. You can hear us Tuesday at noon. We're repeated at 7 p.m. on this fine community radio station. Be a friend. Tell a friend about KHOI. We are a best-kept secret here, and we don't want to be secret anymore. Share KHOI with a friend. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.
Up the dew. He was sitting in a chair all scrubbed up and combed his hair. Alcohol was sweet on the air. So Alice stood before him, that 44 cool against her thigh. And she said, T minus 10.